So, David, was that as horrible as it looked?
Yeah, it was.
People don't know Brad Wiggins. You know, you've got to live in the shoes of Brad Wiggins to understand what the pressure must have been of the first British Tour winner, you know?
Our aim was to create a British team, to try and win the world's biggest bike race with a British rider and do it clean. And what we've done it twice.
With exclusive interviews and the best analysis on two wheels, this is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. Welcome to 2015. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello again, Richard.
And Daniel Freeb.
Hello, chaps. Happy New Year.
Thank you.
Where are we, Lionel?
We're back on home soil, the National Theatre on London's South Bank. It's been our regular podcasting venue for about the last year, really, and we'll be here every week leading up to the Tour de France. When we won't be here, we'll be at the Tour de France.
Yeah, we'll be elsewhere as well. We're going to be, you know, taking in races, Paris-Roubaix is one we're all going to. There's various other Paris-Nice, things like that. Anyway, in today's show, we're going to be discussing the first racing of 2015 in Australia and Argentina, including Cadel Evans' final World Tour race at the Tour Down Under. Daniel was recently at the Etix Quickstep training camp in the south of Spain, and he has an interview with Mark Cavendish. We'll also be announcing how you can become a friend of the Cycling Podcast and help to support us in giving a free weekly podcast, which will be also be daily at the Tour de France. But let's kick things off with a quick sort of recap on what's happened since we last brought you a podcast. And I think the last one, it was a bit shambolic just before Christmas. There was a bit of wine drunk between parts one and two. And we had an interview with Alex Dowsett talking about his attempt on the hour record. Sadly, after a training camp in Mallorca, he crashed and broke a collarbone. So he's postponed his hour record attempt. I think he still hopes to go for it in the next couple of months. But that's a shame. Anything else happened, Lionel?
Well, what has happened over the winter? We've had Christmas, of course. Team Wiggins is now a thing. I think we broke the news that Bradley Wiggins was setting up his own team on the Cycling Podcast at the Tour of Britain last year. A few people poo-pooed that idea, but it's come to fruition, and they've announced a roster.
Like Dave Brailsford, they laughed when we said we'd win the Tour de France in 5 years.
Just levelling the scores early in the new year there. Amiga Pharma Quickstep are now Etix Quickstep, so we've got to get used to calling them Etix Quickstep now. The USADA decision on Rabobank has been published now, and there's a lifetime ban, I think, for Geert Leinders, the old Rabobank and Team Sky doctor. No doubt we'll talk about that in coming episodes. And Mario Zorzoli, the chief medical officer of the UCI, will probably have some question to answer too. Of course, the big social event of the year should have happened before Christmas, the Cycling Writers of Great Britain Christmas dinner. We had to, or you guys who organise it, Rich and Daniel, had to postpone
it. This year, it was a Daniel and Orla Shinawee gig this year.
Apologies, sorry Orla. Orla took over the organisation. That's perhaps why it ran very smoothly this year, Richard,
really?
Didn't it?
Yeah.
No, not at all. But the special guest was Oleg Tinkoff. The mystery guest was Oleg Tinkoff, which was a surprise to almost everybody in the room. Perhaps Tom Carey, our esteemed colleague at the Telegraph, he already knew that Oleg was in the building. But how did that go?
Well, it went well. I mean, one of the things about the Cycling Writers' Dinner is that the guest comes dressed in fancy costume. We've had Christian Prudhomme last year, and people have to guess who it is. They have to ask questions to which the answer is either yes or no, so it's a nod of the head or a shake of the head. There was somebody in the room, fortunately, who'd obviously been tipped off as to the identity of the mystery guest, Lionel Burney, and who asked him questions like, how's your share price, and what do you think of Nicholas Roach? And that kind of started to give the game away a little bit.
Well, I thought it had got off to a relatively slow start. There wasn't a great rush of questions, and I'd had a couple of beers, so I was feeling emboldened. And perhaps I let the cat out of the bag a bit too early. I don't know.
There were also a few groans, weren't there, when he was wearing a Rafa snood. We didn't go the whole hog this year, and he's another potential mystery guest, Johan Brunel. He's local. He lives in London. We didn't get the full Santa costume this year. Obviously, there were problems with that because usually I nip down Kilburn High Road on the day of the event and spend $3.99 for a felt Santa suit, and which gets demolished on the evening of the event. This year, it being January and me not being very organised, there was no real Santa suit. So what did we kind of improvise? We had a Santa hat, we had a Rafa snood, we had some sunglasses, and when the disguise came off, there were a few groans, there were a few "oh no, not hims," which Oleg was not very pleased with.
He picked up on that, and that got the evening off to he got off on the wrong foot, really. He did spend about 10 minutes giving us a lecture on how journalists should conduct themselves and how they should behave, which was not perhaps in the spirit of things. I don't think he really understood there was a sort of humorous bent to the evening until we did our now famous raffle, yeah. Wasn't it? Or not a raffle, sorry, it was an awards... We have ceremony. An awards ceremony where prizes are given out, kindly donated by Prendas shop, and they usually send a real... great selection of goodies or baddies, you know, such as US Postal caps, also the
Sonia Deval musettes.
Sonia Deval musettes. Oleg Tinkov actually won a T-Mobile musette, yeah. And I think he walked off as well with a signed Alexander Vinokourov poster of him winning Liège-Bastogne-Liège, so a nice souvenir. And I think at that point he started to understand there was a bit of humour to the evening.
And the award was, can we remember what award it was? I think it was the Oleg Tinkov Award for most fractious relationship with Dave Brailsford, wasn't it?
Well, that was definitely the lesson we took from the evening. I think that he does spend quite a lot of time thinking and talking about Dave Brailsford. What also came across speaking to Tinkov over the course of the night, and he is a sort of Marmite figure, love him or hate him, he is obsessed by cycling. It is more than, you know, running a team is more than a sort of far more than an opportunity to publicise Tinkov credit systems. He is following a passion that he has. He was obsessed with all manner of cycling and you know the riders on his team and how they're going to approach the season, which was quite interesting.
Very bullish, wasn't he, about the coming season 2015? There's obviously been a lot of publicity or a lot of coverage of the staff changes at Tinkoff Saxo. They've taken various people, well, both this year and in previous seasons from Team Sky. They've got Bobby Julik on board, who was a coach or formerly at CSC with Bjarne Riis, and when he retired himself, and then went to Team Sky, was very successful there in his work with Chris Froome, has now been, well, he lost his job at Team Sky, didn't he, when he confessed that he had doped during his racing career, then went to BMC, now back with Riis and Tinkov at Tinkov Saxo, and Tinkov described him as the best coach in the world. He's very excited about the work that Julik is going to do with Peter Sagan, who's also his nearly a neighbour, because Peter Sagan has moved to Monte Carlo. Bobby Julik is based in Nice. And just about Sagan in general, he was quite confident that he'll be able to get him back firing again and winning classics certainly this year.
He's certainly looking good on the golf course, Peter Sagan. He was playing a bit of bike golf at a training camp recently. Yeah.
Peter Sagan looks to have been training very, very, very hard for rest days in Grand Tours this year. He's been doing a lot of leisure activities.
I think Peter Sagan's main competition this year could be Danny McCaskill, the Scottish trials rider. Anyway, let's talk about the racing, because there has been some racing. I saw quite a lot of the Tour Down Under. I don't know how much of that you guys saw. It was very, as ever, aggressive racing, short stages. The Aussies were as up for it as they always are. They dominated the race, dominated the podium, all the top three on the podium, Richie Porte, Cadel Evans and Rohan Dennis, all Australian, but it was a good race. There weren't any. There were a couple of bunch sprints, but there was no sign of Marcel Kittel, who'd won the opening criterium, but has actually got a terrible record at the Tour Down Under, and you know, for one reason or another, didn't feature in any of the stages. Steele van Hoff won one of the bunch, really the only bunch sprint. So it was a good race. Man of the match, probably Jack Bobridge, who won stage one. He is kind of like the Australian Bradley Wiggins in a way, but 9 years younger than him, 25 years old. He's given it a good bash in Europe, but he's had a lot of problems, and he's ended up back in Australia riding for a small team, Team Budget Forklifts, and targeting the Rio Olympic Games, the way he was speaking, it's as if, you know, that's where his focus is now, that he's given up completely on the road. And yet, you know, he put in a really good performance. He's going for the hour record this weekend, in fact. And, you know, he looked far from being finished as a road rider. And I just wonder if he might be tempted at some point to give it another go. Lionel?
Well, you would think so, wouldn't you? I mean, unfortunately, it's a career. If he focuses just on the track and Rio, where do you go from there? He'll still only be 26. He's got a lot of talent. It didn't work out for him really at Garmin, did it, when it would have looked like a perfect fit for him there. He perhaps just needs to reboot and go again, a little bit like perhaps Adam Blythe, who spent a year out with NFTO and is stepping back into World Tour level. You know, not everybody can follow the perfect career path on the road. Not everybody adjusts and adapts. And I think sometimes we're a little guilty of not taking into account how much more of a lifestyle change and a life change it is for a young Australian to come to Europe. Some will adapt brilliantly. Others may find it a lot harder.
I mean, Cannondale Garmin didn't have a great Tour Down Under, but a lot of their ex-riders did. We mentioned earlier, Steele Von Hoff is a former. He missed out in the merger over the winter between the Cannondale and the Garmin Sharp teams, and you know, he's had to take a step back as well, riding for NFTO as well this year, the British team. Rohan Dennis, you know, who moved to BMC last August before the Tour of Spain, was the outright winner of the Tour Down Under, and again, another rider going for their record, and showed really terrific form. Sorry, he showed glimpses of that at the Tour of California last year when he was second to Bradley Wiggins. You know, he's developing. He's 24 now, developing into a good sort of all-round bike rider.
Yeah, it's been, I mean, you mentioned Bobridge there and his sort of failure to emerge to the extent that we expected. It's been a bit of a theme in this generation of Australian, young Australian riders that, once upon a time, 20, 30 years ago, when the first Australians came over, we were told that they were exceptionally hungry for success because they'd come so far and it'd been such a big commitment. And there was a kind of natural selection, only that the hungriest, most committed riders actually made it in that generation. I think we're going to talk about Cadel Evans a bit later. That was certainly a characteristic of his career. But of late, the last few years, the peloton has been flooded with Australian riders. There's a big Australian team now, and some of them had struggled to adjust. They've had off the bike problems. In Bobridge's case, there was a drink driving incident in Girona a couple of years ago, and there's also the suggestion that Green Edge has become a bit of a meal ticket for some of them. They've lost motivation because there are too many spots available perhaps now for talented Australians, and I think some of them have had to reset slightly. This is something that, you know, Matt Goss is going to have to do this year. He went to Green Edge on a huge contract and has now found himself at MTM Quebeca. And I think at this point in his career, he realises that, you know, he's got potentially a few years left, and it's make or break for him. And I think it's the same for Bobridge, perhaps.
Yeah, Bobridge, you should mention as well, has had health issues. He was diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis a few years ago, and he's been managing that condition as well. That might have had an impact too on his ability to withstand the rigours of European racing. He's certainly not stepped up to Grand Tour. I remember 2010 at the Tour Down Under, him and Cameron Meyer actually were two incredibly talented young Aussies who you just thought the sky was the limit for those guys. I mean, they were very, they had a great attitude. They were getting in breaks all the time, attacking all the time, obviously very strong as well. And Cameron Meyer is another one who, you know, is forging a decent career for himself. He's a former Tour Down Under winner. Looked very strong this year at the Tour Down Under, working mainly for Daryl Impey, his Orica Green Edge teammate from South Africa. But hasn't sort of kicked on in the way that we might have expected. You know, maybe we can point the finger at, you know, similar to Geraint Thomas in a way, where you look at these guys and think he's got a lot of talent. He spends a lot of time at the front of the bunch, clearly very strong, but doesn't perhaps have the results, the wins that you might expect.
Well, yeah, I mean, the World Tour teams are so big now, 26, 27, 28 riders. There's competition for spaces in races. We shouldn't overlook the fact that the reason Rohan Dennis and Jack Bobridge are in such hot form so early, not only is because the Tour Down Under's their home World Tour race, but also they've got imminent attacks on the World Hour record. So that's given them a focus. It's given them a goal that they can really tailor some preparation towards. And I think when it must be very easy to get lost in that sea of 26 riders, 26 other riders, to have a goal to focus on, particularly in the European season terms, right at the start of the year. It's given them something to aim for, and we've seen already, you know, they've hit the ground running in 2015.
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Download old episodes absolutely free at thecyclingpodcast.com.
Okay, we're going to discuss in a moment the career of Cadel Evans, who bowed out of the World Tour level at the Tour Down Under by finishing third overall in the end. But we want to also tell you about a new thing that we're launching in 2015. We're starting a friend scheme, Become a Friend of the Cycling Podcast. And it's to raise a bit of money for the podcast, because we have a media partner, the Telegraph, to whom we're very grateful. We will be looking for sponsors for certain races, but there are costs associated with the podcast which we need to meet, and we are committed to offering a free weekly podcast and a daily free podcast at the Tour de France. That will not change, but we are, in addition to that, going to be offering a monthly exclusive Friends podcast, which can be landing in your inbox or accessed by you if you're a friend of the podcast for the measly sum of £5 for the year. We won't be asking for any more than that. £5 for the year, I think that's $7.50. It's probably about 30 euros the way the euro is going at the moment. No, it's about 8 euros or something. It's 7 euros, 8 euros. It's pretty reasonable. That's going to be the fee for the year. That will get you a monthly exclusive podcast, which will be a little bit different, hopefully a little bit special. And yeah, anything to add to that, fellas? Do you want to add your own plea?
It's about what you pay for a sort of flat white you have, isn't it, Rich? I think that's the...
In the sort of cafes you go to, up your neck of the woods.
Hipster coffee emporium in my neck of the woods.
It's actually the price of two bowls of cereal in that cereal cafe in the east end of London, in East London. So up your way, Lionel, probably gets you about, I don't know, lunch, three-course lunch.
A mortgage.
Steady on. I don't know where you think I live, but no, mortgages are substantially more in my neck of the woods than a fiver. Yeah, I don't think you can say fairer than that. £5 for 12 special podcasts, and to become a friend of the podcast, and you will be acknowledged if you wish on our website as well.
Lionel sounds like he's considering investing himself. He sounds like he might even fork out himself.
I might give it a bash. As I say, we are committed to giving you a free weekly podcast and a free daily podcast at the tour. This is in addition to that, but a lot of you will want to miss out on this. We're also this year going to be offering a range of things like t-shirts with slogans from the podcast. All details of all this will be on our website, www.thecyclingpodcast.com. Please log into there to see how you become a friend of the podcast, get a t-shirt, all the rest of it. We would appreciate whatever support you can offer. It will help us to keep this free podcast, so thank you very much in advance. We'll be plugging that probably relentlessly throughout the year. Anyway, let's talk about Cadel Evans, because he is poised to retire. He rode extremely well in Tour Down Under. He's 37, he'll be 38 next month. I think he's 38 on Valentine's Day, isn't he? So we're going to say goodbye to Cadel Evans. I think the Tour Down Under, although he was extremely competitive, confirmed that he's making the right decision. I think we've seen over the last couple of years, you know, he's not quite the force that he was. His strength has been sort of just ebbing away. There was a changing of the guard at BMC with Rohan Dennis winning the race. Perhaps Dennis's win owed something to the fact that he was riding with Evans, and, you know, the moment where the race was won, perhaps, you know, he wasn't followed because people were watching Evans a bit too closely. But, you know, he bows out as Australia's greatest ever rider. I don't think there's any debate about that, is there, Lionel?
No, first and only so far Australian to win the Tour de France. Incredibly consistent in the Grand Tours once he finally made that breakthrough, and you could rely on him being in the top 5-6 pretty much every time he started a Grand Tour, and his record is incredible, really. It became very fashionable to knock Cadel Evans because of his riding style. It's not perhaps the most comfortable to look at. He's not an angel of the mountains, is he? He was a grinder, he was a grafter. He rode in what looked like quite an uncomfortable way. He wasn't explosive and exciting in that sense, but you know, he he never gave less than 100%. He even when he was on a bad day, and there were several in the Giro and in the Tour, it was almost like torture watching him lose, because he wouldn't give up. He would pour absolutely everything he had, even if he was losing 10-15 minutes.
Yeah, an immensely strong rider, wasn't he? Sort of very resilient, tenacious. Some of his best performances, I think, came in one day races as well. The World Championship win in 2009 in Mendrisio, on what for my money is probably the hardest course of the last 15 years, perhaps since Colombia in 1995. That was an incredible performance. Not a particularly, as you said, not a particularly inspiring celebration. And then this was, he barely lifted and raised an arm from the handlebars, didn't he? And you know, you mentioned his riding style. I think in the media as well, a lot of us had reservations about, well, certainly our dealings with Evans. He could be a prickly character. The infamous incidents from his Tour de France career, swatting away microphones, etc. But in spite of that, you really had to just doff your cap and respect the rider. My first experience with Cadel Evans dates back to, I think, 2001. I was working for Mappe in Milan at the time in the marketing department, and Cadel Evans was kind of smuggled into the building one day because he'd been riding for the Cannondale mountain bike team, and then he'd finished the 2001 season with the Psycho Cannondale road team, and it looked very likely that he would turn professional for Psycho. But Mappe kind of swooped for him and enticed him away. And he came into the building one day with Tony Rominger, who was his manager, Mark Beaver, who was another one of his associates. And they went upstairs and signed the contract with Dr. Squincy, the owner of Mappe. And they happened to leave his contract open on the computer in a Word document. So I managed to, I think before Cadel Evans knew what his bonuses were going to be in his first contract with Mappe, I think I'd seen them. And then of course
hang on, we can't let that go. What were his bonuses, Daniel?
I vaguely remember his bonus for the Tour de France victory being about €400,000.
That was pretty safe, that was at the time.
Well, having said that, the following year in May, as a debutant on the Giro d'Italia, first Grand Tour, he almost won, didn't he? He came within 3 days of winning, very famously bonked.
What kind of bonus was he on to wear the pink jersey for a few days and then blow up spectacularly?
that of course was that Giro. It kind of heralded, well, the end of Mappe's time in cycling, because it was the Giro when Stefano Garzelli tested positive for, who was the Mappe leader, for probenecid early in the race, and Cadel Evans was kind of drafted in he was promoted as a kind of makeshift leader, and he really surprised everyone by taking the pink jersey and coming very, very close to winning the race.
But there is a sense, isn't there, that Evans represents a generation of riders who were denied by some of the excesses of the doping culture, and that when he won the Tour in 2011, it was a believable victory, that his career is credible and believable, and there's been nothing to connect him to doping. There have been a few associations, one of which you've kind of alluded to earlier, perhaps already, Daniel, his agent was Tony Rominger, who's a rider who in the 90s was connected to some people who we now know were involved with doping. So there are threads there to pick away at. But Evans himself leaves with his reputation intact, doesn't he?
Yeah, I mean, he was always a difficult one to judge on that score, because you talk to someone like Greg LeMond. Greg LeMond will say that Cadel Evans exemplifies the pure natural talent who, you know, came onto the scene in 2002, his first season as a road rider, immediately was very competitive, and that was evidence of this phenomenal...
Before that, as a mountain biker.
As a mountain biker, phenomenal performances as a teenager in international mountain bike events. But on the other hand, there are episodes like, 2011, when he won the Tour de France, I think any journalist who was in the room that day when he did his winner's press conference was very, very disappointed with the way he answered questions on doping and his body language, etc. Having said that, we've already said that he was not someone who really played the sort of PR game, and he was not someone who would have necessarily put up a facade for the sake of journalists. So perhaps, you know, that was just seeing him really not having any truck with journalists trying to ruin his party.
Yeah, and it could say more about his regard for journalists, his relationship with journalists, which was always very, very difficult and frosty. The only time I remember there being a sort of you mentioned that he didn't play the PR game. The time that he did play the PR game and it sort of backfired, was it 2008 when he was in the yellow jersey in Po, and his then team Lotto, whatever they were called at the time, Marc Sargeant managed team, held a barbecue and a sort of Australian themed press gathering, which was seemed to be celebrating the tour victory well before it happened, and obviously it didn't happen that year. I think it was 2008, wasn't it?
It was,
and it was a very nice barbecue and an occasion, but it did feel extremely premature at the time, and so it proved.
Yeah, well, that was the year that he really got worked over by CSC on Alpe d'Huez, wasn't it, with the Schlecks and Carlos Sastre. You know, it was a well worked out move, and
also the terrible crash.
That's right, yeah, he'd had the terrible crash, and I think even going into the final time trial, there were people who still thought that Evans would overhaul the deficit he had on Sastre, but you know, that wasn't, he wasn't able to do that. I'm trying to remember where that was now. Was that at Saint-Armand, Montrond? It was right in the centre of France. It was a real, it's that lumpy course that they've used one way and then used the other way.
I remember that time trial that there was, it was pretty close, and it did seem as though Evans might, you know, overhaul Sastre. It's interesting because there's parallels with 2011 when he did, when it was time trial right, you know, one day before Paris. But I remember doing a sort of poll of riders, you know, asking them who do you think is going to win the tour, and going around a few riders from different teams and going to David Miller, you know, who do you think will win the tour? And he said, I don't give up. And I'll have to put in a bleep at that point, because it's an interesting insight into how riders are so focused on themselves, they don't really care about what's going on in the race.
That was also the day, Rich, when two of Carlos Sastre's teammates, Kurt Aslett-Arveson and Stuart O'Grady, got wrestled out of the press room. And there'd been a controversy prior to that Tour de France, or had been rumbling on for a few months, I think, about CSC allegedly compiling dossiers on journalists, and journalists who were and weren't friendly to the team. And as fairly frequently happens on the penultimate day time trial of the tour, riders float into the press room because the team vehicles are stuck at the finish. They find it difficult to get back to the hotel, so they've really got nothing to do and they're looking for somewhere to watch the race. So a couple of the CSC riders ambled into the press room, and there was a bit of a kerfuffle, wasn't there? And we looked up from our laptops to see the Tour de France press chief at the time, Mathieu Desplats, sort of rugby tackling Stuart O'Grady and Kurt Aslett-Arveson, telling them in no uncertain terms that this was not their place of work. This was for the journalists, and they had to leave. And there was a bit of argy-bargy.
You don't let us on your buses,
yes,
wasn't it? That was. So, anyway, Cadel Evans. I think he leaves the sport with his head held high. He will remain in the sport working for BMC. I'm sure we'll see him around. It'll be interesting to see if he is a bit more approachable now in retirement. You know, some riders, when they're competing, just find the pressure of competition too much. Robert Miller was one, for example, who was always incredibly prickly at races and did sort of mellow a little bit in retirement. I wonder if Cadel Evans, who, there are parallels, I think, between Robert Miller and Cadel Evans, similar sorts of personalities in a lot of ways. I wonder if he will maybe we'll get him on the podcast this year. Maybe that'll be one of our special podcasts. The Friends Scheme will be a sit down with Cadel Evans. That'd be good, wouldn't it? That'll get a few people signing up, parting with their £5.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Freeb.
Okay, so the other race that's been going on in the first part of January is the Tour de San Luis in Argentina. If you've been managing to watch that, then good luck to you. The camera sort of work or the moving images from that race have left a lot to be desired. It's not been like watching the Tour Down Under, but it's been a noteworthy race, mainly for the to watch the form of Mark Cavendish. Now, Daniel, you were at the Etics Quickstep training camp in the south of Spain a couple of weeks ago, and you spoke to Mark Cavendish, and let's hear from him now. This is before the Tour de San Luis. Then we'll come back and talk about his form and what the season might hold for Cavendish.
I did some 6 days. I started early because I started training. I took a week off after the Tour of Britain, and then I was going to start again, and then my wife got sick, so I didn't. So it was pretty much a few days after the World Championships was, I started training again. Which is normal, that's when I'm stopping racing. So I started early, but I just ran my bike. I did the 6 days and then carried on training over the Christmas. It gave me a kind of short-term goal to get fit for. And then it complements my leg speed for the road anyway. You know, I used to always supplement some track training in the past anyway throughout the season to get a leg speed and be able to sit at a high speed and comfortable revolutions. That kind of just helped with that, really.
Did you kind of lock into that pretty quickly, or did it take you a long time to get back to the sensation you used to have when you used to ride a lot on the track?
It's pretty quick, man. I actually feel more natural getting on the track than I do even when I start on the road again.
That's
what my body's made to do, actually, is that track. I'm not meant to do this shit.
Yeah. And Sam Raimi, are you excited about finishing on Via Roma?
I am, yeah. It's the race I grew up watching, you know. It's like the races I remember. It's Milan San Remo. I know it's changed throughout the years, but that's how my generation will remember San Remo, you know. So I'm super excited about it. I'm loving it. I missed a tour last year. Like, I love it. I don't know if I don't want to kind of not miss it. I don't want to miss it again, so I'm kind of excited for as long as I can do it, really.
Does that mean Lefebvre thinks you've got 3 more years at his team?
I don't know. I don't know. I'm really happy. I love it here. Like, really do. Really do love it here, you know. The riders, the management, staff. It's super good.
Has it started to feel a bit more like HTC now that it seems that Rolf's influence has grown?
Well, if you look now, like, we've got 5 new riders this year, all from a different country.
Yeah.
You know, it's really getting like HTC. You know, we've got the best equipment and really structured on developing young riders, scouting, and that's a super good place to be. It's a real good ambience, you know. Like, really, really is a good ambience. Like, really nice feeling. And you see that in how we won by far the most races last year of any team, and over half the team won races, and that was a similar thing to what happened with HTC. It shows that it's not just focused on one person, 2 people. We go out together. Okay, the media is obviously going to be more interested in 1 or 2 people, but the team's focused on just winning, so it's nice. And I really feel like they have a belief in me. Like, that's really nice to have, you know. Like, I can say I think I'm going to do something, and I do, you know. Like I said to Patrick, after I got sick after San Remo, and I was like, look, if I do scale the price, I won't be getting over it. So let me take this block to train, and I'll win in Turkey, California, Swiss tour. And I won in Turkey, California, Swiss. And I'd have won in the tour, you know. And Patrick, he saw that, you know, and he really believes me. Rolf's known the whole career, Brian has, and that's real nice to have a belief, like, you know. To be fair, I've never been sure. Whatever team I've been in, I've never had a kind of... the odd director sport team probably didn't have a belief in it, you know. But as a whole, my teams have all been.
Mark, you're 30 in May. Are you starting to feel old?
Yeah, man. Look at my hair. I've got grey hair, man.
Like, you've been saying that for years.
No, I'll have a meltdown when I'm 30. But I'll have a breakdown, sure. Sure, it just wait. Be a good thing or a bad thing. But I'm happy, like, professionally, done pretty much everything I want to do in my life. I've got the most beautiful family in the world. I think I couldn't wish for anything else before I was 30, so I've got not got much to kind of worry about getting old.
You said you've achieved pretty much everything you want to achieve in a professional life. If you could have like one last cherry on the cake, would it be another Sam Raimi? Would it be the tour stages record?
I want one last cherry on the cake. Are you kidding me? I'm greedy.
What?
No, I want a bag of cherries on the cake. And then I want another cake.
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Join us on Twitter and Facebook. Just search online for the Cycling Podcast.
Okay, so we heard there from Mark Cavendish speaking in the south of Spain before he flew out to Argentina to be beaten 2 days in a row by Fernando Gaviria, the young 20-year-old Colombian sprinter. Very unusual to have a Colombian sprinter, but he's a good track rider. Formerly a speed skater, I was interested to read on the excellent Alps Andes blog, which is run by Klaus Bellon, a Colombian that we know who lives in the US and writes very well on Colombian riders as soon as they start to emerge.
So what about Leonardo Duque? Surely you know, Colombian sprinter?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, apologies for that, Lionel. He's not the first Colombian sprinter, but he did beat Mark Cavendish 2 days in a row. And Cavendish finally got his first victory of 2015 on the final stage at the Tour de San Luis. So he's got off the mark. But what did you make of Cavendish's performances down under in Argentina, Daniel?
Well, it was a bit of a false start, wasn't it? He didn't get off to the best of starts, losing those two sprints. His team were, well, certainly in the second one of those sprints, his team were really outclassed by Gaviria's, or certainly, obviously not yet ready in terms of form, in terms of physical condition, because they were badly swamped in the last kilometre, and Cavendish was really 50 metres behind Gaviria before he even started his sprint. There have been no major problems for Cavendish this winter. He has ridden a bit on the track. He said he told me in Spain that he got his track speed back fairly quickly. It wasn't too difficult. He even said he still feels his body is really made for that more than it is for the road. But yeah, some question marks, I think, definitely. Sabatini was his lead out man, the new signing from he's come from Cannondale, an old friend of Cavendish, old training partner, lives not too far away in Tuscany. He took on the role of lead out man in San Luis. Mark Renshaw wasn't there. Renshaw will be his lead out man for the rest of the season. Sabatini's really not cut out for that job. He's more of a sort of penultimate man in the train. So there are questions about the team, certainly, lingering from last year. There are questions about how Cavendish is going to measure up to Kittel. And we've got, you know, Milan-San Remo coming up in March. That is a huge race, I think, for Cav this year, not least because this is the last year of his contract. He wants to stay at Etix Quick Step. They would like to keep him, but I don't think they'll keep him at any price. I think that might be quite a tough negotiation if, you know, he doesn't really have a fast start to the season.
It's quite interesting to see him being convincingly beaten by a young, very, very quick rider, a rider almost in his mould, you could say, because when Cavendish burst onto the scene, that's what he had. He had this incredible acceleration, and that's what you talk about, you know, Cavendish's sprint train maybe letting him down. But what kind of sprint train did Gaviria have? You know, I mean, he you know, we talked about this the other day, Daniel, how Cavendish almost sowed the seeds of his own downfall in a way by raising the bar in terms of sprinting, both in terms of his own abilities as a sprinter and in the organisation of the team around him. And sprinting now is a different game, isn't it, to what it was a few years ago?
Yeah, it's interesting. For all the performance statistics and analysis we now have, I think it'd be interesting if this year the focus moved away a bit from climbing speeds and how fast they are, how dubious they are, and could perhaps give us a real clear comparison of sprinting speeds, both head-to-head, because we know Kittel and Cavendish don't race a lot against each other, but also by comparison with the past, or wattages, speeds, etc. I mean, there's a lot of speculation about has Cavendish slowed down? Is Kittel faster than Cavendish ever was? You know, I spoke to Mark in Calpe about his debut season 2007 when he won 11 races for T-Mobile without any kind of train. And, you know, this is something that Tinkoff said to us at the Cycling Writers' Dinner. He would like to have Cavendish on the team without a train. He thinks that Cavendish doesn't need a train. Cav says that it's just impossible these days. There are so many trains that anyone who doesn't have one is severely handicapped. Whether that is true or not, we don't know. I mean, that he's certainly better placed to judge that than us.
I think we should be a bit careful about reading too much into results and performances from the Tour de San Luis or even the Tour Down Under. These are the pre-season friendlies, really, of the cycling season. And we naturally do it every year, even the Tour of Qatar and the Tour of Oman and the races in the south of Spain. We read a lot into who's winning, who's doing well, who's not. But really, these are just the kind of where everyone's reacquainting themselves with competition, trying things out. Mark, when I spoke to Cavendish in the middle of last year, I asked him about San Luis and why he'd chosen to start there a couple of times, and he's chosen to go back there again. This time he said because it's low key, there's no real spotlight on them there. There's not a great deal of media. And they can try a few things out and just get back on the bike.
I agree with you, Lionel. What's interesting is the consistent level of performance that we see now from riders. You know, there's Richie Port at the Tour Down Under riding exceptionally well. His stage win at Willunga Hill was really impressive, and he's aiming for the Giro. And I think what we see now across the board, sprinters and GC riders, is They do maintain a very, very high level, and it can be important, as Richie Port said it was, to start the season extremely well. There doesn't seem to be the same don't seem to be the same extremes of peaking and troughing as there were in the past.
I quite agree, but to read into getting beaten by a 20-year-old Colombian that's indicative of one thing or the other, I just think a bit of a stretch too far. That's all.
I also think the first 2 or 3 months of the season this year are extremely important for Cavendish, not only because of his contract, but also for his confidence. It's almost a bit of a stretch to think of Cavendish as someone who might lack confidence. It seems so at odds with his kind of public persona, but I think inevitably the last year or so has eaten away a little bit of his confidence, certainly as far as the rivalry with Kittel is concerned. And in terms of the decision-making in the last kilometre, this is something we saw at Harrogate last year in the Tour de France. You know, he says he doesn't think about that anymore, Cavendish. He doesn't dwell on the crash that he had there. However, one reading of that was that it was at the sprint of a guy who was perhaps lacking a bit of confidence, wasn't completely secure in his ability to beat his rival, who was Kittel, on that day. So I think it is important for him to get that boost and really feel that he's the best, the king of the jungle again.
But in terms of how this all fits into the landscape of cycling, the season's a narrative. Week old. The narrative of cycling, thank you, Richard.
Yes, yeah, with marketing. What's the US marketing guy got to say about the Tour de San Luis?
I've got some tragic news about US marketing guy. Unfortunately, I heard he was shredding some documents just before Christmas. I don't know why. And his tie got caught. And let's just say it didn't work out well.
I've got, for our new friend scheme, I've got an image of a Lord Kitchener style US marketing guy poster. You know, US marketing guy needs you to fork out £5 for a friend scheme. So maybe we'll resurrect him from that big cigar in his mouth. And listen, should we wrap up there? I know you were about to, you know, go off on one there, Lionel, but
I wouldn't say go off on one. I was just going to make the point that we're entering a kind of a new era, so to speak. Velon, this organisation of some of the teams, is coming to the fore to try and make cycling more viewer-friendly and more appealing.
There'll be an interview with one of the masterminds of the Velon project, Bessel Koch, who is a co-owner of Quickstep Team, in a forthcoming edition of the podcast. I've completely forgotten that I interviewed him in Calpe, Spain, but that will be in a forthcoming podcast.
Excellent. But my point was going to be, L'Equipe did an editorial about how dreadful to watch the Tour de San Luis was on television, and from what I caught, it wasn't very good at all. But they're on the flip side. You know, why are we watching this? You know, why would
it's
you feel
racing,
yeah, but
we love it.
I do. As I've said to you in the past, Richard, I will watch any bike racing that you choose to put on Eurosport, but it has to be of a there has to be a base level standard when it comes to the picture quality, surely.
I agree. The picture quality was better from Jeremy Roy's bike, wasn't it, at the Tour Down Under? Anyway, we should really wrap up there. We don't want to go on too long in our opening podcast of the season. It is a long season. We've got to do these additional special podcasts now as well. The demand, you know, the demands are going up. It's like having a one fewer rest day or something. Anyway, let's go and turn our attention to that. Thank you very much for listening to our first podcast of 2015, first of many. Please do support Cycling Podcast through our new friends scheme. Details on www.thecyclingpodcast.com. My name is Richard Moore. Daniel Freeb, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Lionel Burney, thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more episodes of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.